Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. Today I'll be passing myself off as your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is renowned Criterion blogger and podcaster David Blakesley, or so he claims.
The one and only. Hey, I'm happy to be back with your podcast, Lady P. This is a fun show to be a part of, and I'm looking forward to this new discussion.
Excellent. And helping us parse truth from fiction in his FlixWise debut is Islamic history professor from the University of Pennsylvania and self-proclaimed film geek, Paul M. Cobb. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Delighted to be here. It's a huge honor.
Today's Sight and Sound entry is the 43rd film on the Greatest of All Time list, Abbas Kiarostami's Close Up. Close Up is an Iranian film about the nature of film. Now, if that doesn't land square in the middle of the Venn diagram of Paul's interest, I don't know what does. But let's not be presumptuous. You'll have to listen up to hear what all of us really think about Kiarostami's movie in our discussion today. Our second topic was actually inspired by a conversation I had on Twitter. One of our listeners, Joshua Wilson, mentioned that Close Up was the movie that inspired him to start his blog. Well, that started the wheels turning in my head, and I now bring you a conversation about the movies that made us. I feel like I need more dramatic music right now. But we're going to talk about the movies that changed our lives, for better or for worse, and then we'll close things out with a few final notes of positivity. All right, you guys ready to question everything you see and hear?
Heck yeah.
I'm ready to blur the lines between art and reality.
Exactly. Wonderful. All in a day's work.
Carriage return.
Our first topic is Abbas Kiarostami's 1990 movie, Close Up. The film is essentially a documentary, though some may quibble with that classification. Indeed, part of the purpose of Close Up is to question our accepted notions of the documentary as undoctored or unbiased truth. The film follows the arrest and trial of Hossein Sabzian. Now, I might need some help with the pronunciations.
You're doing great.
And I was told that someone was willing to step in and provide backup.
You can count on me.
Thank you, Paul. Hossein Sabzian, a man accused of impersonating a famous Iranian director named Mohsen Makhmalbaf to try and swindle a well-to-do family, the Ankhans.
Way to go.
Huh?
Yep.
Is that right?
Good.
Okay. Ankhans. Into investing in a potential movie production of his. The events of the film are all presumably true. Sabzian really did try to pass himself off as Makhmalbaf. The catch is that everyone in the film is playing themselves. Kiarostami gets all involved, including the hoodwinked family members, to reenact their parts. He combines the reenacted scenes with footage from the courtroom of the Sabzian trial. Though it's unclear to me exactly how much of the trial was orchestrated and possibly even scripted by Kiarostami. During the trial, we see flashbacks of Sabzian's interaction with the Ankhans. How would you say it, Paul?
Ahenha.
Oh my God. That was beautiful.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. How to say it again?
Ahancha.
Ahancha.
You're doing great.
Thanks. And we see how he was able to ingratiate himself into the family. However, it is clear that his desire to be seen as Makhmalbaf didn't stem from malevolence or a corrupt nature, but from a genuine desire to be perceived as a great filmmaker. Sabzian, playing himself, offers a sensitive and sympathetic portrayal of a man who desperately wants to be taken seriously as an artist and was willing to go to inappropriate lengths to achieve his dream. As I mentioned before, Close Up is about film. It's about keeping the audience on his toes, blurring the lines between documentary and narrative storytelling. Kiarostami seems skeptical of the connection between film-goer and filmmaker. Sabzian, a man unable to distinguish between what is real and what is not, is the ultimate victim of the great swindle perpetrated by movie makers on their public. At least that's this podcaster's opinion, but let's hear what the other folks on the panel make of Close Up. All right, David, how about we start with you? Sure. You like close-up?
Yeah. I definitely enjoyed watching this film. Now, this is the first time I'd seen it just this past week, so I kind of accepted this assignment just kind of on good faith to say, okay, Playtime, the last time I was on this program, was a film I'd watched many times over the year. So it's like, let's take a different approach and just jump in on something that will have been pretty new to me by the time I get around to actually making a recording. So I was very impressed and very intrigued. Now, I have seen a few other Kiarostami films. A Certified Copy, actually wrote about that for Criterion Cast a couple years ago when it was kind of a new release on Blu-ray and DVD. And I actually, several years ago, inherited or kind of received a DVD of Through the Olive Trees from a friend. Who was just kind of lightening his load. He's getting ready to do some traveling and relocation. So he just given all stuff away. And he gave me Through the Olive Trees, which was actually an Iranian DVD, or maybe it was an American DVD, but it was made for the Iranian community here in the States. And so it does have English subtitles, but it's not at all kind of what I would consider the standard art house edition of a Kiarostami film. It was really made for people who speak Iranian or from that native culture. And so I watched that a few years ago and was definitely intrigued with, again, how he kind of plays games of sorts with the audience about what's the real movie and when do you sort of step out of the conventional narrative. So I've had a little exposure to Kiarostami, but I still consider myself a novice because he seems like a filmmaker just based on this limited exposure that one would really need to sort of sink into and really kind of catch up on his work to really get a good grasp. But this film, as I understand, is kind of his masterpiece, and that's very worthy of that title. This is a very intriguing and thought provoking film, but one where I'm still kind of mentally processing a lot of it. And so, what people are going to hear in this episode is me kind of sorting out my thoughts a little bit on the fly. I've got a few ideas, a few points I want to make, but I'm still kind of putting the pieces together here.
Okay. All right. Well, Paul, how about you? What do you make of Close Up?
Well, I just want to say about David's thoughts on the fly. I think those are often the best kind, because they're fresh and they can, I think they'll pique people's interest. I like David, agree that Kiarostami's work is, there's a lot of it, and he is a sort of filmmaker I think you need to sit down and sink your teeth into. And I haven't done that yet. I've only seen two other films of his, Taste of Cherry and The Wind Will Carry Us, mm-hmm. ages ago. It's funny. I think people, because I teach Middle East history, people think I know a lot about Middle East film, but the truth of the matter is I don't. I'm a self-professed film geek, but I tend towards sort of classic Hollywood, really, if you had to push me. So my exposure to Close Up was just because of the buzz that was being generated by it here in the States in the mid to late 90s after it had really come out. But I tended to, in fact, avoid a lot of Middle Eastern cinema just because it was sort of like work. It could often be very didactic or kind of ham-fistedly political. And when I saw Close Up for the first time, it was a revelation because it was none of those things. It was mm-hmm. beautiful and mysterious and also thought-provoking and intriguing in so many ways. I really think it is Kiarostami's masterpiece, though, to be fair, I haven't seen his complete body of work. But it is a remarkable film that repays rewatching. This will be the in preparation for this episode, I think I watched it for the third time.
Okay.
So it's a short little film, but there's a lot happening.
There's a lot going on, that's for sure. I have to say, This pains me to say, but I generally do not like Abbas Kiarostami films. I feel like a fraud, to be honest, because here I am purporting to be some kind of film nerd or cinephile, and I don't even like Abbas Kiarostami.
Nah. I don't think people should feel obliged to like any particular, film or filmmaker just because they're, you know, they have a certain reputation. I think, you know. Love what you love, Lady P. That's right. What I say.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
and you. I totally endorse that. I mean, you're kind of doing an inventory of the Sight and Sound list most recent edition, right? And so
that is correct.
There's a obligation, if you will, to cover this film, and so tell it like it is. If you don't like it, don't fake it.
yeah. I guess it's better to be honest. But I just, for me, have you both seen F for Fake?
Yes.
I just think that film is such a great mic drop on this subject. I mean, F for Fake is an Orson Welles film, I believe from 1973, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of a documentary about a famous art forger, but then halfway through it goes off on this other tangent, and it's all done in a documentary style that all purports to be truthful, but in the end we realize that Orson Welles has been conning us the entire time. But the trick with that movie is that he takes such delight in conning us, and the kind of cloak and dagger routine is so, I don't know, it's so well handled that we kind of love that when we are duped, when we realize that we have been deceived. It's kind of, it is like someone pulled a magic trick. It's like someone pulling a rabbit out of their hat or something, you know, or the magician has made his assistant disappear. Whereas this film, I just feel like it's covering similar terrain, but it does it in this really heavy-handed, ponderous way. And I know what I am saying here is sacrilegious. I understand that. But I don't, I just, and I have to say that I enjoy Close Up a lot more than I like some of the other Kiarostami films that I have seen.
Yeah, same here.
I really, really, okay, so I've seen The Wind Will Carry Us. And that, to me, is a perfect illustration of why the saying, write what you know, is utter nonsense, because you end up with just lots of movies about self-important directors.
Right.
And at least that one is kind of self-critical, so I'll give it kind of a pass. And it's lyrical, and I enjoyed that one okay. Certified Copy. David, I know you wrote about it.
Yes.
So maybe we can fight about this, but generally speaking, the only movies that I truly despise are movies that are racist, sexist, homophobic, overly misanthropic, or sadistic. Certified Copy is none of those things. And yet, I really hate that movie.
Yeah, I was just thinking, where does it fall on that checklist there? And
exactly.
I didn't really see any of that.
Yeah, not at all. And for some reason, just, I don't know why, because there's plenty of movies on the Sight and Sound list that are kind of really in love with exploring the form or really enjoy kind of defying audience expectation. But to me, Certified Copy and to a lesser extent, Close Up, just kind of play like someone who's just discovered post-structuralism. Like, just really kind of pretentious.
Damn.
I know. Not great. I know. I feel bad saying this. Well, I know.
It's there. Let it be known, you know?
Yeah.
I think we'll be
it's
kind. I can't guarantee what your Twitter feed or email traffic is going to do to you, but we'll be nice enough.
Okay, good. Okay. You can feel free to tell me I'm wrong and to defend these movies because, like I said, I you know, do searches online, and it's very difficult to find anything remotely critical about his work. I mean, just the praise is so effusive. And so I just kind of left scratching my head a lot of the time. But I don't want to dwell on my negativity.
Mm-hmm.
people probably didn't tune into this podcast to hear a negative review of Close Up.
I think we'll balance things out enough.
Okay.
I mean, well, you know, not to jump ahead too much, but I don't know that I would put it at 43 on any list of films I'd make. So, you know, there's that. But we'll analyze that a little bit more.
I mean, we'll definitely get there.
You know, so you talk about somebody who's just discovered post-structuralism. Well, I have no idea where Kiarostami's coming at from his, you know, philosophical worldview or anything. But even given that, you know, there's not a lot of quality post-structuralist entertainment out there, so you know, let's enjoy it for what it is.
It's a niche market.
Yeah, right. And certified copy. These are kind of cinematic sleight of hand. It's above M. Night Shyamalan, you know, where he's throwing his little patented twist endings at you, because there's a little bit more art and a little more ingenuity. And this is a real story. I mean, this isn't, you know, certainly Kiarostami saying, okay, what's going to be my version of F for fake? I don't know, again, how much Orson Welles, I'm sure he probably was aware of Orson Welles and, you know, had, some influence or knowledge of F for fake or whatever. But this was an actual event that happened, you know, very close to this time. And I think just the proximity and the fact that it involved another, you know, peer filmmaker, Makhmubov, and Kiarostami saw an opportunity to sort of capture this unusual happening, you know, in his own terms, and that legitimizes this film quite a bit, and it is a look at Iranian society that I think is very valuable. Again, I'm pretty late to the party, having just watched this film for the first time last week, but I've known of Kiarostami's reputation for several years. Like I said, seen a couple of his films. Now I'm just sort of seeing what the buzz is about, and I do feel like perhaps a lot of that lofty praise that you're referring to, Lady P, is the fact that there's just a generation of film critics who have, you know, a fondness for this guy, and maybe they appreciate his willingness to, you know, create very unique art out of a society that's, you know, quite poorly represented in mainstream Western media. And that he's having to work against some pretty, you know, sometimes challenging circumstances to make his films, you know. And I definitely want to hear more of what Paul says about, you know, his knowledge of Iranian culture and, you know, society and government and religion and all those things. Because I definitely get the sense of Kiarostami as a man who is a very aware of all these, this kind of, you know, narrow pathway of expression, of freedom of expression that he has. You know, there's nothing really sexy. There's nothing really impious. There's nothing, you know, profane or radical in the sense of, you know, challenging his cultural status quo here. He's just, you know, he's telling a story in a very unique, unconventional manner, and managing to, you know, kind of gain a worldwide audience in the process.
Paul, care to comment?
Sure, I'd love to. I should preface everything by saying, look, I'm really not an expert. I mean, I read on the Crusades, you know, that kind of stuff, medieval stuff. So my expertise on the contemporary Iranian film industry is pretty limited. But I can I'll do my best. I did want to sort of acknowledge, Lady P, what you were saying. It's about Welles. It's definitely true that F for Fake has a twinkle in its eye. You know, it's much more. Like you said, you know, Welles is a magician. He loved magic, and that film is in a way a kind of giant illusion for us all to sort of clap and giggle at the end. And Close Up is, by contrast, a bit more serious, maybe self-serious in a way. There's not much in the way of a twinkle, but there is a lot of a sort of pensiveness to it. And I think that has something to do with where Kiarostami is coming from, where after the Iranian Revolution in 79, I think cinema was thrown into question for a lot of the reasons that David was alluding to. It's a powerful medium, and the new Islamic Republic, I'm sure, had doubts about the content of films that had been made, certainly, and thus films that would be made. And so the sorts of films that did get made, that Kiarostami and his peers, like Makhmubov, made after 79 tended to be arty movies and movies that engaged critically with social ideas, or at least with some kind of social thought. So there's usually, at least in Kiarostami's work that I've seen, a kind of philosophical angle that you don't really see in Wells. Wells is playful. Kiarostami is more philosophical. And so it's maybe two different approaches to the same conundrum of reality, of illusion and reality. But yeah. But let me try and sell you on this movie, all right?
Please.
Why I'm able to watch it more than once is because it is, in a way, maybe because of the way it's edited, it's a kind of make-your-own-adventure movie, in the sense that you can watch it adhering to one character or one point of view one time, let's say the journalist, and then you can watch it a second time and be absorbed by Sabzian or by the father of the Ahnkha family, or, you know, so you can sort of shift your focus, no pun intended, each time you watch the movie. And I found I got something new out of each time I watched it, by paying attention to the perspectives of the different characters.
Yeah, and I will say that as I started thinking more about this movie in preparation for this podcast, I should also say I've watched it, I believe, twice now.
Uh-huh.
And I did appreciate different things with each viewing. And just thinking about it, I realized that there is a lot to process in this movie. There is the meta element about how we perceive movies that have this kind of cinema verite style and the kind of what is supposed to be kind of a close approximation of reality, or this kind of documentary style of filmmaking, and how at a certain point you can't really tell the difference between documentary and the footage that was shot later, and really kind of calling attention to the authorial voice, that, you know, the person behind the camera is ultimately the one carving the story. And then there's also the story of Sabzian, who, you know, as a cinephile, I think I relate enormously to him and his desire to sort of associate himself with greatness.
Oh, totally. Doesn't your heart break for him?
A little bit. Actually, I think, who was it that went years later did a documentary that kind of followed up?
Well, it is included. It's included in the package. What is the name of it here? Close Up Long Shot. But it is a follow-up to Sabzian some years later, well after the film had become famous and had kind of cemented his legend, if you will.
Right, it's a wonderful documentary. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It is. But it definitely, well, I'll just say, you know, I work in kind of mental health as professional, and you know, when I was watching Close Up the first time through, it's like, yeah, I get Sabzian has a very, you know, sensitive artistic soul, and that scene in the courtroom, you know, where his mother just sort of starts blurting out, you know, he's just a poor man and couldn't support his wife and child, and you sort of see the kind of pathetic little reality that stands behind this, you know, kind of hasty illusion that he was throwing up there, this impersonation and this kind of grandiose stunt of, you know, posing as Makhmalbaf. But when you get behind it, it's like, oh man, this isn't some, you know, snickering con artist who's out to run a swindle. He's really got some delusions. And his talk about the blurring the line between art and reality, he's kind of a sad example of that. And I think you definitely get that in the follow-up documentary. This is a man who's really got some, you know, psychological problems. And again, I want to be sensitive about that myself, because I'm viewing him through this kind of Western you know, lens of secularized, technologically advanced society and just the cultural matrix that I come from. But I say, and I don't want to be this armchair, you know, psychologist or anything like that, but you can sort of see from the testimony of the people who knew Sabzian just as an everyday person, not as this kind of, you know, charming slash pitiful character on the screen, this aspiring artist who's really never going to get his break, except that he sort of did by virtue of being in this movie. I mean, he is a part of the cinematic pantheon now. I mean, that's a pretty lofty achievement for a guy. But, you know, after that moment passed, he has the rest of his life to live. And that was a pretty depressing little story in a way, because he just doesn't have that ability to sort of focus up and you know, really even just take care of himself. I mean, it cost him his marriage, his relationships, and I don't think he had a real fulfilling existence, you know, despite achieving this particular ambition of wanting to be involved in a great work of art, you know, which was kind of his driving passion leading up to the creation of this film. And so, yeah, there are just all these really weird paradoxical things going on. And just think about all the events that had to fall into place for this film to come into existence. And then, you know, Kiarostami, again, you know, he could have taken a more conventional documentary. Let me tell you the story about Hossein Sabzian, you know, and with a narrative voiceover and all that. But he weaves this kind of spell where you're kind of in this story of things that happened, and it's really, I think, really crucial for the viewer to understand. And it does say this is based on true events, so you get sort of get that at the beginning. But I think it's the meta story beyond just watching the film. It's the knowledge that we have as we're watching it, or what we learn afterwards, that really, I think, sort of galvanizes our attention and says, "Wow, this is pretty extraordinary." Because there's a reality to it, but there's an artifice to it. And how do you sort of separate the two, or can you even separate the two? I mean, Kiarostami's kind of woven something together that isn't just memory. It's not just a story that's being told. It's a story that's being enacted. And because it's the very characters themselves, there's just something kind of jarring about that.
Mm-hmm. I think...
Well,
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead, Paul.
Oh, I was just going to say that, I mean, David just then really put his finger on what is for me the reason why I love the film. And that is because it sort of invites audience participation in a way. It requires the audience to be involved in deciding what's real, what's not. Deciding what the narrative of events is, and the viewer can never be just a passive viewer of this film. You're always engaged somehow in what's happening on the screen, and that's what sort of woke me up to this movie. Whereas, you know, other movies, I have, you know, there are lots of movies that I love to watch, but I'm sort of a passive participant. In this film, you're sort of constantly questioning what you're seeing, and for that reason, I really love it. I also wanted to say that David also touched upon something that you mentioned, Lady P, about all these positive reviews, and that is definitely something that's a red flag for me, and it makes me think that, well, if everything is so gushing, then probably someone hasn't really sat down to not everyone has seen the film. There's usually at least some kind of variety. But,
or there's just a critical kind of peer pressure. You got to get on board. I mean, Lady P, I mean, your guilt or your reluctance to just sort of express your indifference, you know, I mean, you did, so I commend you for that. But this feeling of like, oh man, I'm letting people down because I'm not part of the chorus. You know? And I mean, that really absolutely does happen. It happens on the mass popular level as well as the critical cinephile level. And we sometimes have to sort of catch ourselves and decide, do I like it because I'm supposed to, or am I really absorbed into this? I mean, has the filmmaker really caught me? And everybody's experience is different, and there's just because you're into film doesn't mean you just automatically get swept away, you know?
Yeah. Just because you're into film doesn't mean you have to be into this film, right?
Right, exactly. And I have to say, I think if this was my first experience with Kiarostami, I might be more appreciative of kind of the the formal daring of the thing. But just given how much I disliked certified copy, that might be playing into my feelings of this film.
Well, you know, Kiarostami did have some critics. I think some people thought and still think that he's in a way exploited Sabzian and all his.
Yeah.
I think that's a very legitimate charge. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Sure.
And also, you know, he has a name. Iranian cinema is a vast and wonderful thing, and one hears about Kiarostami because he made it to the festival circuit in Europe, really.
Right.
A fate that a lot of his colleagues in Iran have not yet experienced. So there is a certain amount of criticism that he's getting more attention than he might really deserve.
I don't know. I think you really nailed it, David. It's just I really do feel like I'm letting people down when I say this, and I don't mean to, and I recognize that perhaps it's just a shortcoming of mine, and it's my own bias, and maybe it's just that I see myself in his work. I see the films that I would have made if I were a filmmaker, or if I were a new filmmaker anyway. I went to film school, and this kind of reminds me of like my very first film project.
Right. Yeah.
So,
right.
I think when I identify that, I kind of bristle at it. That impulse. It's just very kind of self-reflexive, very kind of navel-gazy, mm-hmm. Just kind of wanting to be different for the sake of being different.
Well, you know, that's not half wrong. I think seen in the context of Iranian cinema, like before 79, you know, they even used the phrase in Iran to refer to the older generation of movies, film Farsi, as famous actors, maybe some musicals, lots of action, you know, big blockbusters in a way, kind of very mm-hmm. dismissively. And cinema after the revolution was in a way a new style. Kiarostami is often lumped in a movement. I'm not sure how valid the label is, but the Iranian New Wave. So there is a kind of newness to what he was doing, and maybe that's what you're reacting to. These kind of beginner's steps, which lead him to be more kind of pretentious and self-referential, that a more mature filmmaker, you know, mistakes that a more mature film maker might not have made. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I watched a few of his earlier films, and they're kind of they sort of remind me of Italian neorealism.
Yeah, lots of children and villages, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Which I wouldn't say that they're masterpieces, right. But at least they buy into their own conceit,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which especially something like the Taste of Cherry. Really does not.
Yeah.
I think.
Ebert hated Taste of Cherry.
Okay, good. Yes, that makes so much sense, because I think Ebert kind of resented... I remember Usual Suspects. He hated that movie because the whole thing turned out to be a giant lie.
Right. The trickster right. element, right.
Right. Yeah.
Spoilers.
Right. And that is what Taste of Cherry is. It's like... I don't mean to spoil Taste of Cherry for anyone who hasn't seen it, but I feel like I should save people the trouble. This is getting mean. I can't be this catty. This is bad. because I really resented that movie because I really was invested at a certain point, and I was enthralled in certain points. Like, is he going to kill himself? Mm. And how will this end? And then the ending is such a cop-out.
Cop-out, yeah. Yeah.
It's just... yeah, well, I don't... You know, again, I won't spoil it. I will save you all a rant. But, yeah, I think that's... I think I kind of appreciated his earlier movies more. That's not to say that they are masterpieces. But
I just want to say about Taste of Cherry, just for the other side of the equation, I want to plug my friend Arik Devins. His Cinema Gadfly podcast just did an episode on Taste of Cherry.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, that's on the Criterion Cast main feed if you want to give that a spin. He and a friend talked about that. So, yeah, give that a...
Absolutely, we'll do that,
throw a little plug in there, sure.
Yeah. So back to close-up. I guess it's close-up is kind of a good transition point from the kind of pseudo-neorealist films, or not pseudo, but kind of takeoffs of a neorealist film.
Little snapshots into of society and the poor, struggling children and all that. Right, right.
Exactly, yeah. And into the sort of more intellectual, philosophical territory.
Well, I think there are some social aspects to consider in this film. It's not all intellectual head trip and, you know, what's art, what's reality. But this the tension with the
we need your help.
Ankhaz, you're doing fine, really.
Ankhaz, okay. Well, the Anka family is kind of an interesting little case study, you know, because obviously the mother meeting Sabzian and him passing himself off, you know, this little conversation on the bus that really blew up into something much, much larger was really fueled, I think, by the younger brother's, you know, eagerness to almost be taken in a little bit. I mean, they felt like, wow, this is our lucky break. And and the flattery that Sabzian perhaps intuitively, instinctively used to say, oh, your house is perfect, you're going to be stars, I'm going to make my next movie about you. They were kind of gullible. They kind of, you know, swallowed the bait. And
they come out looking very, very badly, I would say.
Yeah, very, very, very petty and somewhat vindictive. I mean, there is a little bit of a reconciliation moment at the end there, and that's fine. But you know, in the courtroom, you see that their dignity has been insulted. I mean, you know, there's been a little bit of a financial transaction, but they've really inflated the case. Well, he was planning to burgle our house, and he's trying to deceive us and lure us into a trap. And the judge, I also appreciate the judge. He's, you know, he's not smirking, but you can just sort of see as he's stroking his beard, nodding his head, he's sort of sizing up this little tiff that's going on that's actually made it all the way to his courtroom. And, you know, he's just looking for a way, because this is probably of a family of some prominence, and they're used to being treated with deference, and they're wealthy, and you can't just kind of laugh them out of court. But he wants to sort of put them in their place. So there's an interesting little social commentary that is going on here about this kind of aspiring family trying to make a little bit of a splash and sort of being taken for a ride by a man who is, you know, actually just a little bit mentally disturbed. So that little dynamic, I thought that was certainly sort of one of my rewatch insights. You know, certainly
that's a great. Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, I do recommend this film to people as the first film to see if they've never seen an Iranian film, even though it's a bit challenging for precisely those reasons. The very last thing you'll ever see in a movie by Kiarostami is a screaming mullah or, you know, flags burning or anything like that. In this movie, you get a great sense of the kind of social dynamics at play in Tehran, and you know that the Ankhaz family is this kind of, you know, middle upper middle class family that almost satirizes itself. You know, I don't think Kiarostami had to do much to allow them to display their foibles to everyone. You know, they're very defensive. They're sort of overly polite in this bourgeois way. You know,
I kind of liked them.
Yeah, I
appreciated. You know, obviously they're pretty petty, and I can't say that I would act any better had I been for a similar ride. But I really liked the mom.
Yeah, she was cool.
You know, and just the customs and making sure your guest is well fed even after you realize that he's been lying to you.
Right, eat your dinner. Right.
On that note, David, you kind of brought this up early on in the discussion. It's the 43rd movie on the Sight and Sound list.
I don't think that ranking is going to be going up any higher.
Okay.
I think once the generation, like I say, I mean, you know, there are people who just sort of, you know, bond with whoever the hot director of their time is, you know, mm-hmm. maybe it's, you know, well, Terrence Malick has his cult following, I've heard somebody, Nicholas Winding Refn, you know, people who are kind of like the it directors of the moment of a particular decade who are, you know, creating, you know, Richard Linklater. I mean, they're, I mean, and it's not to really knock or slam any of those names that I've just dropped there, but, you know, people sort of identify with the cinematic heroes of their generation as like, yeah, these are the ones, this is the Hall of Famer, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think Kurosami was kind of that guy in the 90s and into the 2000s. Whether these films last and really stay in that, I mean, top 50 of all time, that's an incredible honor to bestow upon a yeah. film. And I guess yeah. for me, even though I'm impressed and I would say, yeah, I'm a fan, these are kind of novelty items at this point. I feel like I need to learn a lot more about Iranian cinema, and right now I just don't have that connection point. It doesn't have that resonance with me to say, oh, this is it, you know, not on a very subjective level. Obviously, yeah. a lot of people like Close Up, and so it got a lot of votes, and there it is. But I wouldn't probably put it in my top 100 films, let alone top 50.
Yeah, yeah. Paul, what do you think? 43.
Lady P, I think we are all aerosol cans slowly rolling down a hill.
That's great. What a great line.
That's what I think.
Indeed. Indeed.
But I do think 43, yeah, I mean, top 50 is, look, I love this film. I also love a lot of other films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think 43 is an honor for this film. I could easily see it being listed lower. I do think it belongs in the top 100, though.
Okay.
I think it's a special film and well deserves that honor, at least.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I would like to see more Iranian films mm-hmm. in the top 250 of all time. I would just generally like to see more diversity on the list. We get a lot of European films. We get a lot of Japanese films. We get some American films. So it pains me when I have to say that one of the very few Iranian films on the list, I just don't think is worthy of the top 100. I believe there is only one other Iranian film on the list. It's The House is Black, mm-hmm. which is more than worthy. And that's, I believe, towards the very bottom.
Was that made? I don't know anything about
that
it.
That was in the, I want to say that was made in the 60s.
Okay.
I believe so, yeah.
But that being said, this has definitely piqued my interest in other Iranian filmmakers, and I kind of want to watch some Makhmalbaf.
Yeah, me too. I've never seen anything by Makhmalbaf, and this has piqued my interest.
Yeah, it's I don't believe there are any films of his available for streaming, but if maybe I can check my local video store and see if they have anything that I can rent or purchase or whatever. Because The Cyclist sounds like a fascinating film.
Mm, yeah, it seems to have something that I'd inspired Sabzian.
Yeah, so if nothing else, this film has inspired me to go and watch other Iranian films. This is a fun topic. The movies that made us. All three of us on this panel are self-avowed film nerds, or cinephiles, if you want to get fancy. But I think it's safe to say that we weren't born film aficionados. I don't know about you all, but I didn't start quoting Andre Bazin until I was at least 2 years old.
a prodigy.
We're going to talk about, yeah. We're going to talk about which movies had the greatest impact on our lives, and more specifically, which movies inspired us to learn more about film as an art form. Okay, so who wants to start? Which films have had the greatest impact on your life? Paul, let's start with you.
Okay, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I suppose we'll talk later about films that have had like an emotional impact or an artistic impact. But if I have to be perfectly honest, see, I want to approach this question without pretense, without like making it performative, you know, choosing a movie that, you know, you people will think is cool.
Yeah.
And to be perfectly honest, I have to say that I think, as I said earlier, I tend to I track towards classic Hollywood more than anything else. And that has a lot to do with where I grew up. I grew up in Amherst, Mass., which is a small college town in Western Massachusetts, which has the benefit of having had when I was a kid in the 70s and 80s, a revival cinema, which showed double features for $2.50 of classic films, usually. And an occasional new title, but usually it was classic double features like The Maltese Falcon and Casablanca or what have you. Mm-hmm. So I would say that it was out of that context that I really gained an appreciation for cinema. And I've written about this on my blog, and I really do think it was the real center of my education was my experience at the Amherst Cinema.
That's pretty cool. I was expecting you to say, I don't know, Gremlins or something.
Well, that was also very formative. But I have to say, to be honest, I would say it was probably The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn.
That's a great one.
I like to think I'm, you know, I'm a Stuffield professor, but I like to still think I have a little swash to my buckle. And I would also maybe see Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'd have to, just because, look, anyone who got interested in archaeology as I did, who was born after 1960, and if they say they weren't somehow inspired or interested by Raiders of the Lost Ark, they're lying.
I think that's a very, very common answer. And yeah. It's funny because I've posed this question to other people, and it's always Raiders of the Lost Ark and something European and snooty.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, I also have the snooty answer, which is that I had a unique foreign language education, in that I had French from elementary school, so that we had I had a sequence of French teachers who took us also to Amherst Cinema to look at French movies. So I saw Pocket Change, you know, Truffaut, when I was of that age. And I remember, you know, The Red Balloon, which is really formative for me, that sort of heartbreaking short film about the balloon that's loose in Paris. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Again, those are really great answers. I wish I'd seen Pocket Change as a kid. David, how about you? Greatest impact.
Well, yeah, I've told this story in other places, but and this may sound like I'm just trying to impress people, but a really formative cinematic experience was when I was about 6 or 7 years old. My dad took my family to see 2001: A Space Odyssey. This is in 1968, so I was about I turned 7 that August, so I think it came out before that. So I was 6 years old, and I know that my mom's told the story that, you know, our family really wasn't financially, you know, in a good place to take us all to go see this big Cinerama experience, but we did, and I just remember just being flabbergasted by it. I mean, at the time, of course, the NASA program and boys my age were all into rockets and spaceships and, you know, travel to the moon and all those types of things. But this really just kind of made that whole experience of going into space kind of this tangible reality. And I still remember to have just these childhood memories of the whole, you know, opening sequence of the sort of the ape men kind of in their savage, you know, disputes, and the violence and the mystery of the monolith and the final scenes and just so many moments. And that film has really just sort of been like this little talisman throughout my life. I've seen it many, many times, and I have memories of, what you know, introducing my own children to it and watching them kind of cringe in terror at Hal, the computer, and they're like, you know, they're like 9 or 10 years old, older than me, but and these are boys, you know, my boys in particular were just really in love with computers and video games, but all of a sudden it's like they see the evil, scary side of computers, and just, you know, just watched it earlier this year, local kind of the art house theater in town My son saw it down at the Music Box in Chicago in 70mm a couple months ago. So, you know, it's just, it's like this film that's just really shaped my consciousness, literally. I mean, there's a lot of consciousness altering aspects of that film. Yeah. But 2001 Space Odyssey is really kind of, I guess, where I'd say it all began.
That's beautifully the beginning, put, David. There was 2001. I guess. The greatest impact. It's an unanswerable question, right? The greatest impact. How do you even quantify that? But I think I guess you kind of have to go back to childhood, which it seems we've all done. And when I think about the movies that I loved when I was young, my parents actually didn't let me watch a lot of contemporary cinema. They thought it was probably too smutty, to be honest. So I watched a lot of Golden Age of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. I watched a lot of Wizard of Oz. That, I guess that's probably one of the seminal films of my childhood. And also Meet Me in St. Louis. I guess I had kind of a thing for Judy. Still really love Judy. But I'd say those are probably the two films that I watched over and over again as a kid. And my grandmother had all kinds of VHS tapes, but I think it was mostly Jeanette McDonald movies, which it's a weird thing to be really into when you're 6 years old or whatever. But I guess I really liked it. I don't have a lot of memories.
It's wholesome.
Yeah. I don't remember watching them, but apparently, according to my mother, I absolutely adored them.
Well, Lady P, I was just going to ask, how about at the emotional level? What films had a massive emotional
got me?
Yeah.
I think when I remember being 16 or 17 years old and going to the New Beverly Cinema, which is an old movie theater here in Los Angeles.
Oh, yes, we've heard of it.
Everyone's familiar at this point because a few years ago, Quentin Tarantino bought the place and started playing his own movies. But before Quentin Tarantino got there, they actually showed classic film, classic Hollywood cinema and classic art house cinema. Now they mostly show grindhouse, but that's beside the point. But I remember going there in high school shortly after I got my driver's license. And I remember my friends and I going on an adventure to the New Beverly. And it was this cool, mysterious place that showed, they had a bunch of old prints, old scratchy prints of classic films. Mm. And it was a double feature of Citizen Kane and The Apartment. And I had seen Citizen Kane before, but I'd never seen The Apartment. And I don't know why they would be showing those two films together. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But I watched The Apartment and it blew me away.
Yeah. Shirley MacLaine is dynamite.
She really is. So that's kind of my pick. But how about you guys?
I'll go with the original Fantasia. I mean, there's the pastoral symphony, the Greek mythology always. I mean, it's just so incredibly gorgeous. I pretty much tear up every time when it gets to the end of the day and everything, the world is just kind of settling down. But and again, that's another one where a lot of my bonding with that film was before I was a parent, but certainly my kids have been raised on that. We've just watched that and just had so many wonderful times together. Just all the different parts of that original Disney production really hit wonderful notes, you know. And there's some, even the 2000 version had a few sequences that were pretty special. But some other emotional sort of high points or sometimes low points. Ingmar Bergman really gets to me. Just his work in general, but Scenes from a Marriage. That's a pretty harrowing. And I don't want to give viewers too much of an indication that my marriage is that troubled. But there's certainly anytime I've been with my wife, we've been together it'll be 32 years this summer. So, you know, just going through life, there's going to be those moments, and Scenes from a Marriage definitely captures something so visceral about that intimate relationship that is incredible that a movie can actually cut that close to the bone, you know. And then the late Ozu box set and the later films of Ozu, they just really pierce my soul as well, just because they just capture this I mean, maybe this is kind of talking to where I'm at emotionally in life these days, of just time passing and life and family going through its transitions, and just the reality of that, and how beautiful and exquisite it is, but also how sort of painful and tragic that you just can't capture certain seasons forever. You know, you appreciate them for what they are, but you know they're slipping through your fingers even as you're, you know, enjoying the moment. So, yeah, those are a few that I guess came to mind in as I thought about that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all excellent answers.
Indeed.
I'm nodding my head vigorously, but also pensively.
Yeah.
Paul, how about you? Emotional.
For me, the biggest impact emotionally for me is in two films. One, Malick's The New World, and the other is Swing Time with Fred and Ginger.
Mm, yeah.
There are scenes in both of those films where I will, as David said, weep openly, but it's almost Pavlovian. It's not like I sit in my seat and quietly, you know, tears well up in my eyes. My eyes explode in tears and my jaw drops suddenly like that at very specific scenes. And I think it has a lot to do with, in the case of The New World, I'd been affianced to Mary, the love of my life, who died from cancer, sadly. And the film is very much sort of reminds me of this combination of love and nature and grief that I was experiencing at that time. And the sort of... There's a scene that I'm thinking of where Pocahontas is sort of we know she's going to die, and there's a voice, a typical Malickian voiceover, and much spinning in the and somersaults in the grass, that kind of thing, and you get a sense not just of her and nature's beauty, but also of the life that might have been had she not died. And so that was a very powerful scene for me, and I was not prepared for it. And to this day, when I see that film, I break out in a gasp at that scene, and that's why I love that movie so much. But for Swing Time, it's kind of like what David was saying, this kind of nostalgic, but also sort of, there's a scene where Fred kind of reveals to Ginger that he actually knows how to dance, and they have this very famous dancing sequence in the dance lesson hall.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if you remember the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, pick yourself up, dust yourself off. Start all over again.
Yeah, yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's just gorgeous, and they're just so effortless and beautiful. And the dancing ends in this kind of almost sort of big band sounding crescendo, and they sort of spiral to the right, and then tap to the left, and then hop over the gate, and then out the door to a great adventure. And it's just so beautiful and romantic and lovely, and it it gets me every time. What can I say?
Yeah.
I'm a sap.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, that's great. I really enjoyed hearing that, Paul. Those are beautiful testimonies, if you will. So thanks.
Yeah, very emotional in very different ways. I know about that. it evokes specific memories from your life, and you can relate to The New World in a very specific way. But something like Swing Time, which doesn't purport to be anything other than just a delight, can also be very evocative. It can also evoke tears just in how simple and beautiful it is.
Exactly.
I think it's amazing. Yeah.
A simpler time.
So let's get intellectual now. Let us know.
Let's process and rationalize those feelings.
That's enough of that. We all know movies can be they're, as Roger Ebert famously said, empathy machines. But they can also give us a lot to think about. And I think there's a certain point where if you're really into film, you sort of realize that they don't just come out of thin air, that someone has made them and someone has sculpted or crafted them. And it's not just one person. A lot of people like to give credit to just one person, but I think there's a time when you kind of realize that there is an author behind the movies, and that it is not just a entertainment delivery system. It is a it is a work of art. Someone made this, and I'm wondering if we can kind of pinpoint a moment in our lives where we where that sort of realization hit us. For me, it was watching 8 and a Half, the opening scene, and maybe it's because it is so autobiographical, and I kind of still picture Marcello Mastroianni whenever I think of Fellini.
I have made that same association. I'm sure many of us have. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'd never seen anything like that before. It evokes the kind of the very specific headspace of just kind of the neurotic creative type, but it does so in this very surreal, imaginative way. And that was such a revelation. How about you guys, David?
Well, you know, I can pinpoint the date. It was June 29th, 2008.
Wow.
That was when I posted to my Criterion Reflections blog for the first time, and I actually have that post up on my computer right now, and I openly cite a blog that I had been reading called The Criterion Contraption, written by a guy named Matthew Dessen. I think he lives down by you.
Oh, really?
Down in L.A., Southern California area. And he works in the film industry. Maybe he's relocated. But he started this idea of blogging his way through the Criterion Collection in Spine Order number. And at that time, I wasn't reading a lot of, you know, scholarly film criticism. I mean, Roger Ebert and IMDb and also the DVD Beaver website. I'd been picking up Criterion Collection releases for several years before that. You know, that little collector bug kind of kicked in, and I started sort of, you know, noticing the spine numbers and keeping track of certain directors, and had started getting into Bergman, Fellini, Kurosawa, you know, the big names and all of that. And, of course, Criterion released a lot of those films. So, but his blog was really intriguing to me, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to start journaling my own reactions to these films. And then it was in 2009, towards the end of that first year, where I got the idea of putting them in chronological order and working my way through the whole thing, you know, kind of a self-led education on the history of cinema as kind of curated by Criterion. And so the first movie I wrote about on my blog was Brazil. You know, I did a few others. I did Tulane Blacktop, Young Mr. Lincoln, The Ice Storm, Dazed and Confused. I think that's one that I really strongly identify with autobiographically, if you will, because I'm like the same age as those kids in the summer of 76, you know. So that that film is like my high school years captured on film, you know, sort of like American Graffiti for the generation ahead of me, you know, or behind me, however you want to look at it. So those are a few titles. So that's really the beginning of my film blogging journey. And that's led to the podcasting and other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Paul, how about you?
I can answer this very concretely because I remember the moment and the feeling of shock when I saw again in the Amherst Cinema, when I was way too young to be seeing it, Vertigo.
Okay.
And there was
That's
George Bailey doing terrible things to Kim Novak.
I know.
How dare he? How dare Mr. Hitchcock make him do those things?
Exactly. And then, you know, then I learned about Hitchcock and artifice of clever directors. And it was, I would say that and my love of what I didn't know. I didn't know this term at the time, film noir, but movies like Maltese Falcon and The Big Sleep and so on, which are, you know, they're not hugely arty movies, but I gained a sense of, this is a specific genre of film with specific filmic techniques, although I didn't, of course, have the vocabulary for that, but I understood to appreciate them at that level. So that's really the context out of which I began to see movies as something other than mere entertainment. I started writing about movies pretty recently, and that was largely because, well, I was at a cocktail party, and I think I was boring someone to death talking to them about movies, and that person said, you know an awful lot about movies, which I don't, actually, but I began to think, gosh, I do watch a lot of movies, and maybe this isn't normal. And so I started listening to podcasts like this one.
Sounds perfectly normal to me.
I'm so glad to hear it.
You're amongst friends, Paul.
That's great to hear. My first blog post was about Repulsion because I got into sort of a dialogue on Twitter with the gents over at the Wrong Reel podcast. And horror was not a genre I particularly cared for, and I had to be convinced of it. And so my first blog post was about me coming to terms with horror as a genre that was worth watching, and Repulsion certainly persuaded me of that.
Yeah, I guess for me, it wasn't one movie that prompted me to start this podcast. It was more just the experience of looking at all these best of lists and realizing that there were so many on there that I hadn't seen. And the Sight and Sound list seemed as good a place as any to start. So that's kind of the genesis of this whole thing. but it has certainly led me to other great cinema that I wouldn't have otherwise seen. So, I guess that seems like a pretty good place to stop. But
you're doing the Lord's work.
Thank you. Appreciate it. If anyone wants to share their personal memories of most emotional or what led them down the path of film blogdom, whatever it is, let us know. That was a lovely walk down memory lane. But just to ensure that the good vibes keep flowing, let's close things out with a few final notes of positivity. Let's start with you, David. What's one book, movie, television show, work of art that you've been enjoying lately?
Well, I've actually been getting into the writings of Howard Hampton. I mentioned him on another podcast, the Criterion Cast Chronicles, which is a kind of a new program we've been doing over on the Criterion Cast website. Each of us kind of takes one film that was released in the previous month, and I did The Manchurian Candidate, and I noted it in that conversation that I really appreciated the liner notes of Howard Hampton, who's an essayist who's done a few other films. In fact, he did A Hard Day's Night, and he kind of does this kind of got this rock and roll sensibility to him. But just reading his short article on The Manchurian Candidate, it's like, this guy's a hell of a writer. He's really good, and it just kind of got me to think about how often, even though I enjoy the written essays, I don't really talk about him a whole lot. But I thought, I really need to find out who this guy is and get more of his work. So I ordered the book. I haven't even gotten it yet, but I've been reading his Criterion stuff. He wrote a book called Born in Flames, which I have coming its way soon. It's almost 500 pages long. So it's like an anthology of stuff that he's written over the last 20 years. So I'm just going to give a little shout out to the essayist and I guess he is a professional critic. So not that they don't get, their share of love, but we spend a lot of time talking about the filmmakers and the stars, and how about the people who write about them? And so Howard Hampton is a little bit of a role model and somebody that I really want to kind of explore his work and get more familiar with it. So,
love it. Paul, how about you?
Well, my plug is for a short but very entertaining novel that I just finished by a Philadelphia writer named Andrew Irvin, and it's called Burning Down George Orwell's House. And it's rather cinematic film, novel, actually, for those of you listening. It's a novel about love and loss and the impossibility of isolating yourself, and about whiskey. It's also about really good whiskey. So I highly recommend it.
I like that. Burning Down George Orwell's House.
Mm-hmm. It's about a yuppie who has a crisis of conscience and gives it all away and moves to the island of Jura in the Scottish Hebrides, which is where George Orwell wrote 1984. And he winds up renting Orwell's house, and hilarity ensues. And also enlightenment. So.
Okay. Well, you're both on fire this week.
Yes,
that's
blood
right.
Blood and flames and burning down the house.
Indeed.
I will not be following that trend, but if you give me a minute, maybe.
You can cool us off a little bit there.
I watched the end of the tour recently, and I really enjoyed it.
Did you?
The end of the tour is the 2015 James Ponsoldt, I think that's how you say his name, movie in which Jason Segel plays David Foster Wallace. For those who don't know, kind of Gen X's answer to Ernest Hemingway, genius, legend, etc.
Although he wrote much longer sentences than Ernest Hemingway.
Yes, he did. and Jesse Eisenberg plays David Lipsky, who's a solid writer and biographer. And the movie portrays the two Davids' initial meeting in 1996 when Wallace was on his last stop on his book tour for Infinite Jest. Now, I usually hate biopics, but this film is about David Foster Wallace in the same way that Amadeus is about Mozart, in that it's more the idea of Wallace than it actually is about his life. And it doesn't pretend to have any kind of... There's very little biographical information. But I actually think it's a really interesting companion piece with Close Up. It's nowhere near as formally ambitious, but it kind of tackles some of the themes of Close Up in kind of a more circuitous manner. But it's kind of about authenticity and how an artistic genius can profess to speak or relate to so-called common man, which is kind of a theme that they touch on in Close Up. And the Jesse Eisenberg character, he resents and wants to be David Foster Wallace in equal measure, and ends up adopting a lot of Wallace's habits and just tries to find a way to ingratiate himself into Wallace's life, much like Sabzian does to Makhmalbaf. In both films, it's about how a reporter kind of shapes the narrative of a story and a famous person, and how we can't really know how a persona has an author different from the actual person. Anyway, it's really actually I was surprised because it does seem like kind of generic. Again, not especially formally inventive, but I liked it quite a bit, and I was really impressed by Jason Segel's performance. So there you have it. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what is the movie that's had the greatest impact on your life? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you want to try to come convince me that Close Up is in fact one of the greatest movies of all time, you can find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. And please forgive me if I've insulted you or your favorite film. And if you can somehow muster it within yourself to offer an acquittal, please be sure to rate FlixWise and leave us a nice comment on iTunes. Our next sight and sound entries are The Battle of Algiers and Histoire du Cinéma. I'm not sure which one we're going to do first, probably The Battle of Algiers, but watch social media for updates. Until then, David, it was a pleasure having you back on the show.
I loved it, Lady P. This was a lot of fun, and great to meet you too, Paul.
Likewise.
And David, before we sign off, I just want to give you a chance to plug your work, and where can people find you on the internet?
Well, my blog is Criterion Reflections. I've kind of stopped writing new stuff there, but that's kind of my biggest archive of material. But you can find me at CriterionCast.com, which is where I do the Eclipse Viewer podcast. We'll be talking about Chantal Ackerman.
Indeed.
Ah.
And I do other things on the CriterionCast.com website.
Perfect. And Paul, Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It was an unmitigated pleasure. It was like meeting the Beatles. This has been terrific.
Oh, wow. Wow. Goodness, I could have, you mean I could have been wearing my pajamas and laying in bed?
Oh, heck yeah.
Next time. yeah, we'll have to have you on again very soon.
I'd be delighted.
All right, and where can people find your work?
Well, you can find my blog called The Blog Cineastique at my website, which is, also has stuff related to my my job as a historian at paulmcobb.com. And I can also be found on Twitter at Cobb Pasha. That's C-O-B-B-P-A-S-H-A.
Perfect. All right. Until next time, I guess let's get cracking on our big cinema careers, guys. We're all filmmakers here, as long as we believe it.
Onward and upward.
Onward and upward.